And, too bad. Really not a whole lot of evidence that there was ever anything that really, I mean, you know, the ocean was supposed to rise by 20 feet, 10 feet, 5 feet. Correct. So, and they've been saying that for decades. So, can you show me the flooded streets in Miami where I used to live in New York, in Seattle, Los Angeles, places where, especially Miami, where the highest point in Miami in Florida, I think, is 30 feet. Maybe it's 300 feet, but I mean, the entire state of Florida is barely above the water level. Show me the places, any place. I mean, the Everglades is flooded, but that's not due to global warming. It's a swamp, just like D.C. So what happened to all of the ice that was supposed to be melted by the year 2000? There's a lot of people who will get up and tell you that there is such a thing as global warming and that all of the scientists have agreed. And even that is an absolute hoax. Somebody did a study one time of they did a survey of the studies and concluded from that falsely. It turns out that the vast majority of scientists were behind the idea. It's not true. Nobody knows how many scientists or what percentage of the scientists believe in global warming, but what's the difference between global warming and all of these other hoaxes that we've had to survive since the dawn of, you know, human beings? There are always hoaxes, and the answer to global warming is Marxism. It's the reallocation of wealth. The richer countries have to pay the poorer countries. So whoever came up with it had a clever idea in terms of reallocation of wealth, but it's, where's the proof? Where's the proof for the man or woman on the street? Anyway, here's a little bit about the Paris Accord, which Donald Trump has said that he's going to walk away from it. And this is from Fox News from yesterday. It looks like it might just be text, but I'll find another one for you instead of sitting here and reading it. So here's a question. Is it possible that everybody in the world, all the scientists, the vast majority of scientists, could be fooled? Well, I mean, has it happened before? Yes, of course it's happened before. So why couldn't it have happened this time? Just saying. I mean, and if there was a Paris Accord that everybody agreed to, would it solve global warming? I mean, you were told that you need to switch from bags and paper bags and plastic bags at the supermarket to help save the planet. And then a prominent scientist got up and said, whether people use bags at the store, reusable bags or throwaway bags, is going to have zero impact on global warming. So there's so much. And the thing about this, everybody drives a car, right? All of those cars, according to the theory, add to global warming. So one person who drives a car decides that they're not going to use throwaway bags anymore. They're going to bring their little Trader Joe's reusable bag to the store. And then they look down at the people using throwaway bags and they say to themselves, I'm not part of the problem. I'm part of the answer. And then they go home and they take a shower and they use up a bunch of hot water. Right. And then they take two or three vacations during the year. And I mean, they're just pumping out carbon day and night thinking I'm helping. I'm not harming the planet. And by the way, I mean, the whole theory is such a hoax to begin with, but it's like what I was saying yesterday. We're talking about an aspirational planet that is totally clean, right? No forests are cut down. to make room for houses or for fields to grow things, or God forbid, a shopping center. No water ever has impurities put into it. Nobody ever throws a bag of garbage out the window when they're driving down the store or driving down the road. Reminds me of a quip from Steve Martin. Always remember, never forget, keep a garbage sack in your car, because when it gets full, you can always throw it out the window. So there is this deluded group of people. It's this aspirational society that the aspirations have to be treated as real. There's this group of people, the deluded people out there, who feel that they're not adding to global warming, if there was such a thing. They're helping the earth heal from it, and they're pumping out basically the same exact amount of carbon or more than other people. I mean, how much carbon does Al Gore pump out in his, he's got a, you know, he's worth hundreds of millions of dollars from this cult of global warming. And he's got a vacation home that is 10 times bigger than your house, but he's not causing global warming as he jets around the, you've got all these celebrities, you know, spending tons of money, going back and forth across the globe, promoting global warming initiatives. And it's, they're putting out just colossal amounts of carbon. My argument would be, in part, that they're creating more global warming than the people they hate. The individual, the poor slob, is just trying to make it from day to day. He's got a low paying job and has got kids to put in college, and, you know, can't afford anybody to do their yard, has to do everything themselves. And the average person, they're putting out more cars. So anyway, it's a hoax. Anyway, so here's Prager University. Paris Climate Agreement wouldn't have changed anything anyway.
Much has been made of the Paris Climate Agreement, signed by the leaders of 178 countries in 2016. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, speaking for many, called it a historic turning point. The head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Gina McCarthy, echoed the minister's remark when she testified before the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. The Paris Agreement was, she said, an incredible achievement. But when pressed by committee members to explain exactly how much this treaty would reduce global temperatures, she would not, or could not, say. This combination of grand pronouncements and vague specifics is a good strategy for Paris Agreement fans to take, because the agreement will cost a fortune, but do little to reduce global warming. Consider the Obama administration's signature climate policy, the Clean Power Plan. Using the same climate prediction model that the UN uses, I found that the power plan will accomplish almost nothing. Even if its cuts to carbon dioxide emissions are fully implemented, not just for the 14 years that the Paris Agreement lasts, but for the rest of the century, the Clean Power Plan would reduce the temperature increase in 2100 by just 0.023 degrees Fahrenheit. The president has made further and grander promises of future U.S. carbon cuts, but these are only vaguely outlined. In the unlikely event that all of these extra cuts also happen and are adhered to throughout the rest of the century, the combined reduction in temperatures would be 0.057 degrees. To put it another way, if the U.S. delivers for the whole century on the president's very ambitious rhetoric, it would postpone global warming by about 8 months at the end of the century. Now, let's add in the rest of the world's Paris promises. If we generously assume that the promised carbon cuts for 2030 are not only met, which itself would be a UN first, but sustained throughout the rest of the century, temperatures in 2100 would drop by 0.3 degrees, the equivalent of postponing warming by less than 4 years. Again, that's using the UN's own climate prediction model. But here's the biggest problem. These minuscule benefits do not come free. Quite the contrary. The cost of the Paris Climate Pact is likely to run to $1 to $2 trillion every year based on estimates produced by the Stanford Energy Modeling Forum and the Asia Modeling Exercise. In other words, we will spend at least $100 trillion in order to reduce the temperature by the end of the century by a grand total of 0.3 degrees. Some Paris Agreement supporters defend it by claiming that its real impact on temperatures will be much more significant than the UN model predicts. But this requires mental gymnastics and heroic assumptions. The Climate Action Tracker, widely cited by Paris Agreement fans, predict a temperature reduction of 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. But this prediction is based very heavily on the assumption that even stronger climate policies will be adopted in the future. Actually, 98% of the assumed reductions will come only after 2030, which is what the current Paris Agreement covers. And even such wishful thinking won't achieve anything close to the 2 degrees Celsius reduction that has become the somewhat arbitrary but widely adopted benchmark to avoid the worst effects of global warming. The actual promised emission reductions under the Paris Agreement literally gets us just 1% of the way to the 2 degrees target. 99% of what would be required is put off until after 2030. The Paris Agreement is the wrong solution to a real problem. The right solution will most likely be found through green energy research and development.
All right, so you get the... There is a debate over whether the temperature has increased. The problem with a lot of the, especially the hysterical statements about this, are that we don't know what the temperature of the globe is because it goes from place to place. The idea that you can stick a thermometer into the earth and, you know, so that doesn't happen. The vast majority of the surface of the earth is water. And anyway, I've mentioned this before. They don't have more measuring devices. They have less than they used to have. So there's a debate over whether the temperature is increasing. Okay. The next step is we don't know if there is an increase, what the cause of it is. Next step after that is, well, part of the second step is that the sun is the biggest influencer of temperature on the earth. So you've got people who are really caught up in just kind of a mind-blowing exercise in futility dealing with a non-existent problem and willing to put trillions of dollars down the toilet to have from what I can tell anyway, a non-existing problem. Every weather anomaly, every problem on Earth to global warming. And where's the impact of global warming, you know? So we don't know if there's global warming. We don't know what causes it. But even just setting those two aside, well, you have to assume there's a global warming to care about the problem, the so-called problem. You may not know what causes it, but you have to assume that man causes it, right? Because if something else causes it, how are we going to stop that? Say, increase solar activity or whatever. But then the third question is there anything we could do about it anyway? So now all of these steps are tentative, but the left, in its insane approach to life, in which it thinks it has mastery over everything, it has knowledge of everything and mastery over everything that it's interested in, is going to come in and cause trillions of dollars to be spent in America and other developed nations. And what we were talking about yesterday, aspiration. We aspire for the globe to stay the same temperature. That's one of the assumptions in global warming. Now, even that, to me, is a tentative idea. Is it better to have variations in temperature, or would it be better if the temperature always stayed the same? Where's the study on that, you know? So we want the weather to stay the same, the temperature and everything. And so even though it's not really science, because the scale that it's on is so massive, there's so many unknown factors. And if you think about Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty, anytime you have an equation with more than one unknown variable, you can't predict the outcome. And so there's so many unknowns in global warming that it would be impossible to predict it anyway, even if most of the assumptions were correct. But operationally, want to pour trillions of dollars chasing this problem, a dog chasing its tail. They want to spend trillions of dollars on this when the society only has so many dollars to spend on any problem. What's more important, the failure of the inner city or global warming? Just saying. So anyway, take a little break here and come back. 523-1450-623. And I've got my text machine in the car. I'll dash out and get that and a cup of coffee. We'll be right back. Here's some Allman Brothers saluting the late, great Greg Allman, a live version of Sweet Melissa, acoustic.
Come and go, yeah. Gypsy flies from coast to coast.
All right, so just here's the thing. I think what is a sign of a society that has lost touch with reality, and I think one of the signs is that the society increasingly spends more and more of its resources chasing goals that are either unprovable, like global warming, or destructive, like abortion. And I did an article in a couple of years ago when I studied the economic impact of abortion, something I'd never seen anybody do before. I couldn't find an article on it, so I went ahead and did it. And I found that we were missing trillions of dollars in the economy because of these lost workers. Now, you might say, well, that's kind of a cold-blooded way to look at it, isn't it? And, it's a lot less cold-blooded than taking a baby and sticking it in a blender and pouring it down flushing it down the commode. But so failed policies affect everybody. There's a massive impact of failed policies, and I would say global warming is at the top of the list, because what have we ever gotten out of global warming, the so-called fight against global warming? Well, here is some of the predictions. Just found a couple, but here's from 47 seconds of ABC News failed climate change predictions in 2008. About 10 years ago.
In 2015, we still failed to address the climate problem.
We're going to see more floods, more droughts, more wildfires.
This is what was supposed to happen 2 years ago.
Flames cover hundreds of square miles.
We expect more intense hurricanes.
Well, how warm is it going to get? How much will sea level rise? We don't really know where the end is.
Temperatures have hit dangerous levels.
Agricultural production is dropping because temperatures are rising.
There's about 1 billion people who are malnourished. That number just continually grows.
It's June 8th, 2016. One carton of milk is $12.99.
Gas has reached over $9 a gallon.
All right, so there is an element there is an element in human history that is seems to have really occupied people's imaginations, and that's apocalypticism, whether it is religious or if it is found in world. And an example of the religious apocalyptic movement obviously comes from the word itself. The Bible talks about an apocalypse, but the Muslims have their own apocalypse, and most religions have some version of apocalypse. But the interesting thing is that the apocalypse is also found to a great extent in the secular world, and Marxism has an apocalypse. The global warming movement has an apocalypse. So people are totally fixated on this existential threat to human life on the earth. Undoubtedly, that's natural. It's normal, but we take this fear, this insecurity, and we project it out into global warming, and all of a sudden we have to spend trillions of dollars getting rid of a bogeyman, a ghost, a specter. All right, here is climate change scam, Al Gore, false predictions from InfoWars from 2 years ago.
Capital. Two high-ranking spokesmen for the Center of Naval Analysis spoke of climate change as a national security threat. Rear Admiral Neil Morsetti.
If we act in a coherent and coordinated fashion, not only will we reduce the risk posed to national security and the calls upon our respective armed forces, but we'll enjoy the economic benefits and the better quality of life that comes with that. I'd just like to conclude by saying there is no security solution to climate change, just greater insecurity if we don't act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds reasonable, right? I don't have a problem as long as he doesn't call for a carbon tax.
Within Europe as a whole, money is coming from the emissions trading scheme, where's the price on carbon. And
is that a tax, just a straight up tax, or is it
a
credit?
It's all intents and purposes, it's a tax. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And there's the carbon tax. The carbon tax being something to encourage citizens to reduce their carbon emissions. Meanwhile, military conflicts leave huge carbon footprints, not to mention weapons for our enemies to use against us, but that's another story.
But the debate is settled. Climate change is a fact. And when our children's children look us in the eye and ask if we did all we could to leave them a safer, more stable world with new sources of energy, I want us to be able to say, yes, we did.
You've probably heard that before, that all credible scientists follow the narrative of man-made climate change. But as the founder of the Weather Channel points out, science isn't a consensus.
When you see the government, when you see NASA, when you see other institutions say that 97% of climate scientists agree, do you think they're making it up? I, what I don't understand is how you square that.
Well, that's a manipulated figure, and let me explain it to you. The government, $2.5 billion directly for climate research every year. It only gives that money to scientists who will produce scientific results that support the global warming hypothesis.
And in that full debate, the CNN anchor pitted Mr. Coleman against the CEO of the Weather Channel, who is a businessman, not a scientist. But let's address some of the concerns by those who warn of climate change.
Greenland would also raise sea level almost 20 feet if it went. If Greenland broke up and melted, or if half of Greenland and half of West Antarctica broke up and melted, this is what would happen to the sea level in Florida.
Dire predictions.
This is what would happen to San Francisco Bay. A lot of people live in.
Last I checked, that hasn't happened.
Scientists reported with unprecedented alarm that the North Polar ice cap is, in their words, falling off a cliff. One study estimated that it could be completely gone during summer in less than 22 years. Another new study to be presented by U.S. Navy researchers later this week warns it could happen in as little as 7 years.
That was given in 2007. Now, here is an article from the Daily Telegraph, UK. Rise of sea levels is the greatest lie ever told. And that's the uncompromising verdict of Dr. Mornier, that all of the talk about the sea rising is nothing but a colossal scare story. They Al Gore had predicted a rise of 17 inches by 2100. But the scientist and Mornier was the number one expert, the world's expert on the rise of the sea or the level of the sea, and found out that through his studies, there is virtually no rise of the ocean. So if there's no rising waters, what happened? All right, we'll take a little break here for some local news for you. 635 Kelly O'Connell, AM Les Cruz, 523-1450 and 805-6180 to text in. We'll be right back.
Too sweet, Melissa.
It is June 1, and we're on the verge of withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. Now, here is from AEI Ideas, and which is a website, and it's an economics and financial website. But anyway, this is from 2015, about 2 years ago. Famous or at least spectacularly failed predictions about global warming. Number one, Harvard biologist George Wald estimated civilization will end within 15 or 30 years unless immediate action is taken against problems like global warming. Well, these are really too long to read. I'm just looking for ones that... All right, so I have to find one that's kind of boiled down to go through quickly. But there was a guy by the name of he was a pastor, and he was Thomas Malthus came up with the idea that we were on the verge of a catastrophe, and this is in the 1800s, that the earth was running out of food for people, and that there was too many people on the earth and everything. So this has become the stock story that has been passed down through the ages and is not proven to be true, even though people deeply believe this. There are not increasing numbers of people starving. The problem in the world is obesity, especially in the United States. And all of his other ideas turned out to be false. Society, as populations grow, there is more food. There's more, you know, in the modern world because of science and technology. So... And the more advanced countries become, the less children they have by percent. So anyway, covered that. You get the story. There is no, if you take it off of anecdotes, which is what the left likes to do. There's a every time I talk to my sister, anything to do with the weather. It's another sister of mine in California. Well, I guess people are not going to doubt global warming anymore. And I mean, I can't even bring it up because. Ironically, I can't really talk politics in my own family, but people get too angry. But here's Hillary on this, and then we'll shift on to other Hillary-related news.
Important. You mentioned climate change. Apparently, they're debating in the White House whether to pull out of the Paris Agreement. There are only two nations in the world that are not signatories to the Paris Agreement, Nicaragua and Syria. For the United States to throw our lot in with the very, very small number of countries that have turned their backs on climate change is not only a breach of an agreement. Usually when you come into office, you can try to reform, maybe tinker with agreements, but part of what keeps us going is that America's word is good, and you stand with your prior, you know, administration, whether it was of your party or not. They're looking to throw all that out the window. But what's really stupid about it is they're throwing out the economic opportunities that being part of the Paris Agreement provide for the United States. That is what I find totally incomprehensible. Now, it is going to be interesting to see where they end up. The president is a very impulsive, reactive personality. So if we all like Paris, the Paris Agreement, he may decide to get out of it, not even understanding one bit about what that means or understanding the economic costs of it. You know, somebody's going to really, not more, probably more than one somebody, will really have the market for clean energy exports. China is moving full speed ahead to be that country. Some of the European countries, particularly when it comes to wind, are already there. Israel, I know, has some great research being done, particularly on solar. I mean, there's a huge market that somebody's going to own, and we're giving it up. If, you know, there will be entrepreneurs and businesses, you will do your best to be competitive, but you won't have the full force and support of your government. And I think that is incredibly foolish.
All right. Short question.
So this lady is going on this, basically this blame tour. And she's, anyway, Hillary is still in the middle of total denial. She has not taken any responsibility for the loss that she suffered. Here's a little bit. People are astounded. Even her aides are astounded by her ability, even though she's on this kind of like, what do you want to call it, an old wise woman tour. She's still lashing out at Russia, at Trump, calling Trump, saying that Trump is a Nixon, a Hitler. You know, she's just, she must have a mental health issue.
The background music.
So let's talk about, but it was used. When, I think we've discussed this, you and I have discussed this, this idea of how many years ago did you talk about the vast right-wing conspiracy?
About, let's see, it was probably 98.
Right. Yeah. And at the time, people thought you were
a little crazy.
Right. Okay. what is it like now? How do you look at it now? Because it is used, because you're someone that's got to know that a target's on your back almost every,
yeah.
You know, right now, every bot in Russia is working their way with the last 20 seconds of things you said.
Yes, yeah. Right. Well, I hope we get into this because, look, I take responsibility for every decision I made, but that's not why I lost. So I think it's important that we learn the real lessons from this last campaign. Because the forces that we are up against are not just interested in influencing our elections and our politics. They're going after our economy, and they're going after our unity as a nation. So, yes, back in 98, look, I have been watching this and been, you know, obviously the target for a number of years. And what is hard for people to really except, although now after the election, there's greater understanding, is that there are forces in our country.
She's still wearing the Fresnel glasses that people wear when they have an epileptic fit. That doesn't seem to have helped her brain function. Here's a little bit from Newt.
Joins us. He is also Fox News political contributor and author of the new book, Understanding Trump, which we will ask him about in just a moment. Good to see you this evening, Newt. You know, it was very interesting listening to Hillary Clinton. And as you can see in that timestamp, she said in one moment, I take full responsibility for what happened. And then the next moment, she says, well, I would have won if it weren't for Comey and WikiLeaks. Do you think that she has learned the lessons that everyone else seems to have taken away, or many people took away, from this election.
No, it's interesting. I'm reading Shattered, which I frankly was doubtful about, but it's like watching a car wreck in slow motion. She can't come to grips with reality. She can't come to, you know, and over again in this book, they point out that none of her staff can tell her the truth. The number one problem of the Hillary Clinton campaign was Hillary Clinton. And in the end, she couldn't win a race that they all thought was going to be easy. Now, the number two problem, let's be clear, was Donald J. Trump, who turned out to be an amazingly better candidate than any Democrat thought he could be, and who understood that if he really did his best in western Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in northern Michigan, and in Wisconsin, that he was going to be president. So he won, she lost, and it's kind of sad to watch her repeat this "somebody else made me do it" kind of analysis.
All right, so we'll take our last break here. 523-1450 and 805-6180. Hillary is totally living in a fantasy world. Friends, the blame tour goes on. Here's St. Hillary.
Did the Russians get into this? And I think it's a very important question. So I assume that a lot of the people here may have, and if you haven't, I hope you will, read the declassified report by the intelligence community that came out in early January.
This is 17 agencies.
17 agencies, all in agreement, which I know from my experience as a senator and secretary of state is hard to get. They concluded with high confidence that the Russians ran an extensive information war campaign against my campaign to influence voters in the election. They did it through paid advertising, we think. They did it through false news sites. They did it through these 1,000 agents. They did it through machine learning, which, you know, kept spewing out this stuff over and over again. The algorithms that they developed now. So that was the conclusion. And I think it's fair to ask, how did that actually influence the campaign? And how did they know what messages to deliver? Who told them?
Yeah.
Who were they coordinating with or colluding with?
Obviously, Trump.
Because the Russians historically, in the last couple of decades, and then increasingly, you know, are launching cyber attacks, and they are stealing vast amounts of information, and a lot of the information they've stolen, they've used for internal purposes.
In other words, not my fault. I mean, if you want to know what the takeaway from this is, she might as well be talking about the breeding patterns of unicorns. It would be make about as much the same impact intellectually. Here's more: the DNC was nothing when I showed up.
You know, I set up my campaign and we have our own data operation. I get the nomination. So I'm now the nominee of the Democratic Party. I inherit nothing from the Democratic Party.
What do you mean nothing?
I mean, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong. I had to inject money into it.
This is the DNC.
It's the DNC to keep it going. Okay. Donald Trump, who did nothing about really setting up any kind of data operation, inherits an RNC data foundation that after the Republicans lost in 2012, and they thought they had a very good operation with the setup that Romney did, called Orca. They thought that was really state of the art. They lose. So they raised, best estimates are close to $100 million. They brought in their main vendors. They basically said,
I can't even listen to this anymore. Not my fault. Just that's your takeaway. All right, here's a little Tom Papa. This is more encouraging already. Drunk girlfriend, Tom Papa comedian.
Kind of at a point now where I never feel that great ever. You know, people are like, how are you doing? I'm good. And in my head, I'm like, except for that weird rash on my elbow. Then I go on WebMD. What's with that weird rash on my elbow? It's like, well, you've got poison ivy or cancer. I hate that website. Anything you put in, I've got sniffles. What is that? Common cold or sinus cancer. Now try and go to sleep and think about that for a while. I've been drinking a lot more lately. Not like happy hour drinking, like woo drinking. More like sitting by myself in my kitchen over the kitchen sink under a fluorescent light just staring out the window. Just make it better. Getting drunk is fun. Having your girlfriend get more drunk than you and having to get her in the car at the end of the night, not that much fun. It's like trying to get a toddler in the car after a day at the carnival, isn't it? Where are your shoes? What happened to your shoes? No, stop crying and get in the car. No, I don't hate you. Just get in the car. Did you wet your pants?
Hillary, get in the car. Get out of here. So Hillary is convinced, absolutely convinced, if you listen to the, and maybe this is how she can aid humanity. It's not through her voice, is it? Her voice is like 1,000 fingernails on a chalkboard. It's not through her ideas. There's nothing especially exciting or unique or innovative about her ideas. It's not her history. It's a bit checkered. Maybe she can serve humanity, which is apparently what she always wanted to do, by writing an exhaustive encyclopedia of excuses. What do you think? 659 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450, and 805 6180 for your little text friend. After break on the hour, great hanging out with you this morning. Well, good morning. It is the first day, not only the rest of your life, but of June. And if I've got my calendar correct, and we've got with us, of course, the very modest but highly, highly talented Ben Rawson, who's gracing us with his presence in his Rawson Builder Supply green shirt that says very humbly, just Ben. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Kelly.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, Kelly. You know, this has been I really enjoy getting a chance to come out here on Thursday mornings and sit and talk with you and know that there's people listening out there. I hope that the information that I'm providing is of value to them. And I also hope that if there's specific questions that people have, you're a call-in radio show. So you get callers all the time.
523-1450.
And, you know, just call on in, and I'd be happy to answer
all
any
right.
specific questions.
Before we get into the meat and potatoes of politics, local politics, what do you do if your roof springs a leak?
Well, Kelly, it's time to call a roofer. Right now, of course, we had a lot of rain a couple days ago. It was really funny, Kelly. So my brother and my parents each have a little measuring device, and they've determined that they got over 2 inches at each one of their respective homes.
That's what I experienced.
At my home, Kelly, my truck is still dusty. It didn't even get cleaned off. It didn't rain enough to clean the dust off the hood. So, you know, it's funny how we are very spotty in this community. You'll have rain in one area, and you won't have rain in another area.
In more ways than one.
But, yeah, you know, if you've got a roof leak, you need to stabilize the situation, especially if you can't get a roofer out there that same day. And whether that's putting a tarp over or, I mean, hopefully you don't have to go the bucket routine, but getting some buckets, you want to keep that water as contained as possible so you don't end up with a more significant damage to your
home. All
right,
I have another question. If grandma is living up in the attic, what do you do?
Kelly, then you're probably in trouble.
Could be in trouble already. So I'm driving down. I know I told this, but driving down or up from El Paso, and it's increasingly raining harder to the point where you can barely see out the window, and people are pulling off the road. By the time we get up to Loman, we pull up on Loman, and as we're driving past Tell Shore Loman, the water is coming down so thick, I'm thinking it's got to be between 3 and 5 inches. It has to be because the guy that's driving the car saying, it feels like the car's losing contact with the pavement. I'm like, holy cow. So we pull off and go up to AutoZone and then wait for a while. And it was so bad when we were trying to go into AutoZone, we got soaked with a few feet of, dashing in. And a guy was trying to put on he had to get some windshield wipers. He pulled up onto the sidewalk
to be able to put them on.
To be underneath. So that's, it was just, and when you thought it couldn't get any harder, and then it just kept getting stronger and, lightning flashes and everything. And then I hear your area got nothing. It's so strange.
Yeah. Kelly, it is funny. It's, I love the area we live in, but you can sit outside, you can watch someone getting poured on over on the horizon, and then nothing coming your direction. It is interesting.
So you pull up that road that goes, I don't know the name of it, but the road that goes from Roadrunner up to the Sunset Grill through the golf course.
Golf Club Road.
I just was curious, so I asked my friend to go up there, and he said, are you sure this is a good idea? And I'm, no problem. So we're going up, the water level is so high that at one point it crests, I'm not making this up, it crests over the front of the car, and he says, we'll be lucky if we get through this. So, and you could feel the dirt under the car too. And then finally we got up there and, turned off toward in the direction of my house. And it was amazing. And they've spent a couple of days cleaning up dirt that mm-hmm. came off the hills in this little, it's not a big dirt area in this, but a couple of days and just pile after pile of dirt that they're moving out of the way. So, you go through something like that, and you can't imagine that somewhere across town it's not a drop.
There's no rain. Well, Kelly, it's probably a good time to remind people that if you see standing water, you're not supposed to drive through it, Kelly.
Well, it was more like trying to drive up a river.
Through a river?
Yeah.
That's not very safe either, but I'm glad you made it okay.
Up a river, yeah. All right, so what's going on politically?
Well, Kelly, we've got a quiet week right now with going on with Memorial Day, and I want to make sure to recognize all of those brave men and women that have sacrificed their lives or people that have been injured in the line of duty, and just how blessed we are to have those people here. We're a great country, and this is a great time to remember that. So
what do you, if you're especially anybody has kids or younger kids, what would you say tell their children during this time when America is being accused by people who live inside of America of being a terrible country, selfish, self-centered, greedy, dishonest, that we're bad in the world and that we need to learn our place? What would you tell, what should kids be told about America and our history?
Kelly, I am blessed that both of my grandparents served in our military. And so we spent the weekend and talked a little bit about some of those different stories and how important it is. Of course, my son, who's 8, is just enthralled with anything mechanical. And so seeing pictures and things like that, he's very excited about that. But, it's an important time of telling the stories and remembering where we came from as a country and how long we've been a country. That's incredible in and of itself.
This country was built over a fight for rights. And to this day, we are still very interested in rights. Mm-hmm. And it was a summary of all of the best ideas in the history of Europe over 2,000 years was transplanted over here.
And Kelly, I would say that it was also our founding fathers were very religious, and they prayed a lot, and they had God's guidance in founding this country.
Well, there's a big debate over how religious they were, but after Washington was sworn in, they went over to a nearby church and spent 3 hours in church worshiping God and thanking God. So it was a time of the Enlightenment, but that doesn't mean that the people didn't believe.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what are some of the goals for the next couple of meetings for, say, the next few months for the county commission?
Well, we've got a couple different things coming up, but I would say one of the things that we really need to focus on, again, it's not a real exciting topic to talk about, but based on the rains that we had, it's very important, and that's dams and dam maintenance. We have 90-some dam structures in Doñana County, and many of those structures were built by farmers that were just designed to hold water or slow water. And they weren't designed to protect the residential areas.
All right. So let's say the entire city got 2 inches of rain. What are some of the issues that we would be dealing with during that and afterwards?
Well, Kelly, a lot of it depends on how much came at one time. You know, if it was 2 inches over a day, it allows some of the runoff systems to be able to get that water out of the way. But it would be very substantial, and then you have trying to get it into the river. I mean, that's really where a lot of that water is headed. You've got several challenges with that, and one is the rail line that goes through there. The rail line acts as an unintentional dam, and so you've got only select places that you can get the water across the rail line into the river.
Is there any chance that they would therefore improve the infrastructure and maybe put some culverts under some of these areas?
There are certainly areas that need more. We have in the county, we've got, I think, about 6 different flood plans. But the challenge is once you've got the plan, you got to do something with it. Otherwise, if it's just sitting on the shelf collecting dust, it didn't do anyone any good to say, oh, sorry, you got washed out. We've got this great plan that if we would have enacted, it would have solved the problem.
They had the problem in New Orleans, and there was a lot of corruption in the construction of New Orleans. And they found in the fields around in the areas around New Orleans, they found giant pumps that were bought by the city and the county to put in case it was ever flooded, and they were never installed. Mm-hmm. They're just laying out there.
Well, I think that's the challenge when you have these plans. La Union plan is a good example for me. When he had a big flood there in 2003, we need to work the plan.
Yeah.
Come up with the funding to put it in place.
If anybody has a concern about the area that they're in the flood plan, could you give out your number?
Absolutely. My phone number is 649-4153. And Kelly, if they're concerned about flood plans and that type of thing too, we've got a flood commission's office. Paul Doogie is our flood commissioner, or he's in charge of the flood commission office. And his number is on the county website so that people can contact him and get more information there as well. And that way they can see what the plans are. And then we have to find the funding to make the plans work.
All right. So I understand you're off to a meeting this morning.
I am. I'm headed off to a meeting. I did want to mention real quick that we are looking for applications for the Camino Real Regional Utility Authority Board of Directors. And so that's we're always looking for different boards and things. And I just like to put them out there so that, Kelly, your listeners get a chance to be involved.
Absolutely. And what can people pick up at Rawson's?
Come on by to Rawson Builder Supply if you need to do some repairs to your windows or garage doors. We have had several people come in with water getting underneath their garage door. We've got some different seals that can be put on your driveway for that, or attached to the bottom of your garage door. So whatever needs you might have there, we're happy to help you out.
Thanks a lot. And we're about to have, and we got one call here. So yeah, go ahead. Who's this? God bless you, Josh. We'll be right there.
Thank you.
Congressman Pierce is about to appear on the show. So anyway, always thanks so much, and thanks for sponsoring the show.
Absolutely, Kelly.
Folks, we'll be right back, and we are grateful for the sponsorship and support your local businesses. We'll be right back, 7:18 with Congressman Pierce. Oh, Okay, so we have with us, we're grateful to have Steve Pierce, congressman, long-serving congressman in this part of the world. And, Steve, great to have you on the show, as always.
Hey, nice to be here. We're back in the district for Memorial Day work period. Went to Memorial Day events on Monday, Jowl and Eunice. And the city of Jowl turned out and had a really neat kind of just remembrance and honoring. They had cut the ribbons last November on a new veterans park. I really appreciate that the small communities are doing what they can to remember the people. There were 17 names on the wall through the years that
died
from Jowl. So
are the small communities, do they tend to be a little more conservative than the bigger communities in your experience?
Well, not necessarily. If you go into Lordsburg, it wouldn't necessarily be a conservative community, but it has conservative values. And almost all of the communities, the small communities in New Mexico, and as you get into the Hispanic and the Native Americans, have tremendous service records in the military. And so they spend, no matter what their politics are, they dedicate a lot of energy to remembering those who serve.
Yeah, well, that's great. And I know with your service record, and if you could just remind folks of your time as a pilot.
Sure. I'll just tell people I was a junior here at New Mexico State University when I got the call in 1967 that I had won the draft lottery. And they wanted me to drive to El Paso that morning and get my physical. It took my breath away. Your life changes at a point of, you know, seconds. That's how I ended up in ROTC, so I could finish college, but ended up going to pilot training and then into Vietnam in 1971, 2, and 3. We were in and out all those years there. All of our units that I was assigned to, their mission was in Vietnam.
And what was the plane?
The plan was
not the plan. The plane. What aircraft?
Oh, I flew C-130s and KC-135s, and so flew big stuff. In 1972, we were headed home. They were going to disband. They were starting to spin the war down. We were down to maybe 150,000 troops from about, I think, 500,000 at the highest point. So the decrease was really taking place. Our unit was going to actually deactivate. We had the oldest planes, the C-130s, in the inventory, so they're going to send our planes back to the National Guard. About 3 days before we were all moving en masse, we all had orders, everything. They canceled the orders, sent 4 crews into Vietnam. I was one of the 4 because they were sending the single people. The married people had already sent their wives home, everything, and it was in great chaos. So the single guys got tagged to fly missions, and they just said, you're going to go into these little places called Anlok and Kontum. We all shrugged it off. They're the same as any other name in Vietnam. Got into Cameron Bay, where we staged out of in Cameron, and they said, oh, by the way, y'all have given up this mission, and you're going to go fly in Thailand, and the other base in Taiwan is going to fly this mission. But what was going on was the Easter Tide Offensive from the north. They were sending 150,000 troops down. They were hitting Quang Tri in the north, Anlok and Kontum, one in the south, one in the middle of the country. So the north to south in South Vietnam, C-130s were flying a resupply mission, and that's what I was destined for. Providence stepped in and moved me to a different mission. In the next 30 days from the point that I got in country, 5 C-130s were shot down in that mission. Being one of the 4 initial crews, then my chances of being one of those shot down would have been tremendously high. So again, I just thank Providence for redirecting and putting me on a different mission, because I was highly dangerous at that point in the war.
So just the overall experience, I mean, it must be, just to go into not just the military, but the war theater, the experience changing you forever, really.
Yes.
And what were you aware of that at the time?
Sure, yes. I began to burn with anger, and in that 71, 2, and 3 period, they began to choke off the funds from Congress to the war. It was a political agenda that we're
right.
going to we're going, since we can't get president to get us out of the war, we're going to choke off the funds. So in the U.S., when I was here, we weren't allowed to fly training missions because we needed the fuel to fly war missions, combat missions overseas. I still burn with anger at politicians who would do that, either get the troops out or give them what the hell they need.
But don't isolate them in a way that...
Yeah, you don't take it out
danger.
On your soldiers and leave them in grave danger.
Uh-huh.
The second thing is just the bureaucracy. Just these rules of engagement are are literally written rules that tell soldiers what you can and can't do.
Right.
And so the rules of engagement played out one night. It was in an all-night mission, 12 hours, right over the DMZ. You could hear the battle going on over the north. You could hear the fighter jets over the north. Just coming in at the 2 dusk, a plane gets shot down, 2-seater jet fighter. The rear seater, it was moving toward the ocean. The rear seater goes first, and then the front seater after that. And so the rear seater lands on shore. The pilot, seconds later, is able to hit in the water. Well, the helicopter was there, picked up the pilot, but because of the rules of engagement, they could not come on shore and pick up the back seater. And they're like yards, 100 yards, 200 yards inshore. And they said, we have to, by rules, call to Hawaii. Well, Hawaii's several hours further along. It was dusk here. It was middle of the night in Hawaii. They couldn't get anybody to answer. They finally just, like, the guy is talking, hey, man, I can see you. Get in here. I can hear him getting around me. All that long, we circled. The helicopter wouldn't go in. In the middle of the night, we heard a radio keyed. You always had survival radios. And as that radio keyed, you could hear the gunshots. The next morning, then the helicopter arrives. He had gotten permission. Now he's trying to raise that pilot. We're still on station. We've been circling all night during our mission there. And they try and they try and never got an answer. My assumption is that the keyed radio in the middle of the night, he is keying it as they were preparing to shoot him. And so you find these things where the bureaucracies are immobile. And so I have great animosity against these burdensome bureaucracies that would put our young men and women into harm's way without any mobility and ability to say, hey, it's 200 yards, get in and pick the guy up.
Well, maybe that's something like that happened in Benghazi. But let me ask you this. The rules of engagement were famously under Obama very unpopular and, as you say, illogical and counterproductive and unfair to American service people. Are those being changed?
I'm not sure. That's one thing we're listening for. It takes sometimes those rules of engagement have to go down through the process. Keep in mind that of the tens of thousands of people who work at DOD, the Trump administration still only has 2 people that have been approved to serve, and the Senate is holding up all the approvals. So if there are people down from the Secretary of Defense who don't want those rules of engagement to be changed, then they can slow it down. The rules of engagement under Mr. Obama would made our soldiers, and you had to take enemy fire, and you couldn't just see enemy fire. It had to be directed at you before you could return fire. And you say we're in war. You either get the soldiers out or you let them fight the fight.
Well, there's an idea in there called proportional warfare in which equal fire fights equal fire, right? And that you have to have rules of fairness and all this stuff that seem.
If I'm in a war, I don't care about fairness.
Yeah.
I don't want you to have equal firepower. I want to knock the hell out of you if I'm in war.
Yeah.
So. And that's what infuriates our soldiers. I have been multiple times, probably 8-10 times into the combat theaters. So I go and sit and talk to the soldiers, and they're valiant. They appreciate the opportunity to serve. We appreciate them serving, but they're extremely frustrated with the rules that just handcuff them. If you read the book Lone Survivor, that's the story that really plays out. And if you haven't read it or seen the movie, I would draw you to that. Marcus Luttrell is the only one of the SEALs who survived that encounter. And basically the encounter occurred because they were afraid if they took action that they would be held for murder charges here in the U.S. You have people and you tell them they're in war, and then they worry about the tribunals bringing them and trying them for murder here. That's a constant concern among our soldiers.
Well, you've got this idea that seems like globalism, this attempt to build another Tower of Babel in which the entire world is going to run off the same standards. And it is poison to trying to run a great country like ours, in which we aspire to help other countries and to have this great beacon of freedom and liberty over here and to spread that around the world. It's terrible to see these leftist ideas that come in and poison basic things like trying to fight a war.
it plays out even in the governmental system. It is unthinkable that in the UN, that we in the U.S., with all that we pay, with all of our economy, with all the defense mechanisms that we contribute to the world, that we still only get the same vote as Albania. There should be some dual chamber process and some recognition, you know, and then the House of Representatives, California has far more people than Mexico because they're bigger economy, they're more people. And to give proportional representation is something that's well tested here. So it's, again, it looks like that the U.S. has been willing to accept inferior treatment for all that we contribute to the world in the way of security. Changed that. He went into Germany and said, we're going to rethink our trade. You all have been getting the better end of it. Merkel really took exception to it. Trump says, I like the German people, but I'm not going to stand here and let you take advantage of us in the trade. That's why he was elected. The U.S. workers wanted somebody to speak for them. And so I just, Trump is, you can like or dislike many things he's doing, but he is speaking up for the American worker.
Well, Merkel has really done some crazy and dangerous things. And if you look at the U.K., they say they've got 25,000 jihadists that live on their soil. Who knows how many they have in Germany? They'd brought in 1 million Syrians, and all they care about is doing some sort of a kind of blind do-goodism, or you know, there's no logic to it.
I was talking with a young parliamentarian. She's in the European Parliament from Italy.
Yeah.
Millennial, she's probably 25 and serving in the elected office. And she was saying that when Mr. Trump was first elected, that all of Europe was just frightened and they hated him. She said, now then, as they're dealing with the problems of those refugees, those people who are coming in, the problems they're causing in the social system, they're overwhelming the ability of the local governments to manage them. She said, now the opinion is changing dramatically among the millennials that Mr. Trump has got the answer, that you must check who you're bringing in. You just can't absorb millions of people into your country.
Do you think Europe is lost in terms of being taken over by these waves of immigrants that they want a Sharia government?
The Europeans are afraid that they're lost. Again, we've spoken to several members in the parliaments from the different countries. And they just say that they're not sure that they can reclaim their own countries. And the European Union is continuing to tell them that you still have to bring them in. Not only do you have to bring them in, but you have to give them a check that's equivalent to about 700 or about 900 U.S. dollars per person. So a family of four comes in. They've been living in North Africa. Suddenly they're making $3,600 a month. That's like they have reached nirvana. And so the Europeans are all beginning to ask, what are we doing to ourselves?
There is no compromise in Islam. Islam, as it is rooted in the Middle East, has no, it doesn't take quarter with anybody who disagrees with it. Why do they think if Islam is going to be established in the middle of Europe that it's going to be any different?
I think they have not been thinking about it. And now then some people are raising questions, and then it's this whole attack, like, can't even have the discussion. Same thing that occurs here. And so the attempt to silence people by those who support the radical Islamists is a very dangerous tendency.
Very much so. We're talking to Steve Pearce. Lucky to have him in the studio today. And this must be your 30th or 40th time in here, Steve. It's always great to have you.
Nice to be here and visit. Always enjoy our conversations.
We're going to take a brief break and we'll be back and we're going to switch gears and move topics. But if you have any questions or statements, 523-1450 or 805-61802, text AM Les Cruz the same 1450. And it is 7:39 on the button. We've got Steve Pearce here. Folks, we are lucky to have Steve Pierce in the studio today. It's always great to talk to him and catch up and hear about Memorial Day and in his connection in Vietnam and everything. And but all right, Steve, hard questions. Trump is continually pilloried in the media to the point it's a joke. Not what he's doing is a joke, but the reaction is a joke. It's a pre-established script of how he's failed. He gets up in the morning, he holds his coffee in the wrong hand. When he adjusts his tie, it's with the wrong knot. I mean, every single thing that he does is a sign of imminent failure to the left. And we on the right are just bored out of our minds with all of these attacks against him.
It's the same thing that was occurring in the election. The Washington establishment, the special interest groups, hate Trump. They depend on the trillions of dollars that get put into that public budget, and they're there feeding at the trough, and so they hate him. The media is willing to be their accomplice, and so they just continue this attack from anonymous sources. I keep saying, show me the evidence. What have you got? This whole deal on Russia. Now, think about this from a rational point of view. The charge is that the Russians affected the outcome of the election. To assume that the Russians affected 300,000 votes in Florida,
yeah,
in order to accomplish that.
In Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Iowa.
Who would have sent, if you're the Russians, would you have picked Wisconsin to go into and say, we're going to turn Wisconsin around. I think we can change the election by getting Wisconsin to vote for Trump. No one would have predicted this. This was the American people speaking up out of frustration for the special interest. They were looking for an outsider down the stretch. I think it was simply the outsider status that caused the undecideds to swing for Trump. And yet we're going to postulate that it's the Russians. There's no evidence. Our office has asked, I've repeatedly asked, please show us the evidence. Show us the emails from the Russians. Show us what you have. Comey is saying he briefed himself afterwards that that Trump had tried to affect him, but he didn't call anyone else to tell them, and that's a slight oversight on his part.
But the proof is a memo that was handwritten that somebody else read over the phone to the New York Times.
Yes.
It's got to be the flimsiest bit of evidence I've ever seen.
Yeah, this is the former director of the CIA. He knows processes. He knows that it must be documented. He knows that it's got to stand up in a court of law. And he's the one out there, and you think, these guys are acting like intramural guys. I thought
amateur hour.
Comey should have been fired under President Obama when he did. I mean, the Democrats were assessing correctly. Hey, he shouldn't have gotten in on Hillary. He should have been fired at that point. He should have been fired several months later when he kind of reversed his position. And so I was surprised that Trump even used him. But now then, when Trump fires him, the Democrats were calling for him to fire him at one point, and then when he did, they suddenly attack him. And so this is just whole campaign.
Does he have a mental health issue? He seems so erratic. Not that it really matters he's out of office, but how could somebody that erratic get into an important position and stay there? I have to ask myself.
Yeah, I don't know him personally, so I don't know what his status is. I know that his behavior is very erratic.
So but I'm going back to what you're saying about Russia. There is no nexus. There is no machinery to get from Russia influencing the election to have actually influenced the election.
Yeah. Like I said, how are you going to change 300,000 voters' minds in Florida? That's what. If they affected the election, you have to first of all say, okay, they changed those minds. And they changed the minds of people in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. Now, this was simply people saying we are fed up with Washington. That's what it was.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm delighted with a lot of the things that Trump has done. Whether he needs a personality transplant or not, the decisions that he makes on a regular basis seem to fit in with the conservative worldview.
He said he was going to have a three-part agenda, jobs, 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 and mm-hmm. He is doing that. He said he's going to have a constitutionalist, someone who would support the Constitution and the Supreme Court. He's done it. He said that he's going to reevaluate these trade agreements and again, protect the American worker. He's doing that.
The Paris Accord by itself could save us trillions of dollars.
It's the American consumer will pay far more for electricity under the Paris Accord. There is no enforcement mechanism for any of the other nations in the world. China gets to skate free until 2030. If you don't have to do anything till 2030, I will guarantee you will never do anything. So again, it was a total attack on American jobs and American industry. In this state, we're already reeling because oil and gas is struggling, and it would shut down oil wells because of its rules on the CO2 emissions. And so it would be very harmful to the U.S. and not harmful to other nations. It would be one more assault on the American worker.
Steve, I've heard a kind of a wild theory that's spinning around out there. I heard some people talking about a group of people getting together to ask you to consider running for the governor. Is there any truth to this crazy theory?
We began to get that question last year during about the middle of the year. People really asked, and I said, look, you should not be running one race and thinking about a different race. So we refused to think about it. I was under the assumption, like many people, that Hillary was going to be president and that things were going to continue much the same. And so I visualized that I would start thinking about it in November, December, in the first part of this year. When Mr. Trump was elected, now things began to change radically and dramatically. And I realized that the first 100 days were going to be very important for New Mexico. So I said, okay, I can't look at it during the 100 days because this is lightning fast changes. It affects New Mexico. We've got the budget out, and there are points you can contend with it, but New Mexico got treated actually very well in President Trump's budget, and so the 100 days is over. We're going around the state. 2 weeks ago, we went across the northern part of the state just having group sessions with people coming in, asking the question, will you run, or why would you consider running?
Well, it's got to be flattering to hear that, but I have one question. We have a conservative governor, but our economy is still stalled. If you got elected, do you have any ideas to update the economy?
Absolutely. I would put people back to work in jobs that we used to have. We used to have about 123 mills processing timber in New Mexico. The timber industry was vibrant. That's when we were managing our forest. We weren't clear cutting, but we were select thinning our forests. We had a vibrant timber industry, as many people at one point working in timber as oil and gas. We shut all of those down over the spotted owl regulation. The spotted owl regulation says that we're cutting too much timber and it's affecting our owl's habitat. Well, they 20 years later said, oops, that was a mistake. The logging is not the problem. So we killed an industry over a mistaken regulation.
And then think about it. It's these little symbolic critters that are used to shut down industry all throughout the West. And there's never any response. You find an animal, you call it endangered, and then everything has to shut down.
Everything changes. And so I've already got requests into our government to give us pilot projects to allow us to restart thinning our forest. The next thing that would do is improve the water. We was at Moriarty a couple of weeks ago. They had a forest fire around their well field. The water had dropped 40 feet in the well field over the past years. Since that fire, it's bounced back the full 40 feet and another 20 feet above it.
Very nice.
So our management of the forest is starving our waters, our rivers for water and our aquifers for recharging. So if it would be a multiple purpose thing.
That's ideology trumps science. I know you got to run. Any last concluding thoughts?
Yeah, just people have said that I shouldn't think about it because we might lose the seat I'm in. The polls show differently. They say that a Republican can't win statewide. The polls show very differently. We're within 4 points right now. I'm not even in the race, and if I were between myself
please consider
and Lujan Grisham, it's a very close race, and I just believe that the support mechanisms are there looking for a business person to run the state rather than another lawyer. The last time we had a budget that was in good shape was under a business guy, Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
I didn't appreciate his stance on many things, but he did run the state and kept us in the black with heavy good cash balances. That's been dissipated, and now we're reeling every year. It's time to make the budget try to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, from my perspective, please consider running for governor. I know a lot of people out there, the listeners.
Thank you. Always appreciate the time to talk, Kelly.
Great to talk to you. And, folks, we'll be right back We're grateful to have Steve stop by. We'll be right back with you to finish her up. All right, so great to have Steve on the air, and got some texts here. And okay, so is Pierce planning to run for governor? One of the questions. I'm grateful for Congressman Pierce. Any thoughts on the call for a special prosecutor to New Mexico to investigate UNM for use of harvested, imported parts? I'll ask him that next time. Here's another one. Hillary is in her blame tour for losing. Yes, Mr. Deplorables. Oh, pardon me. Yes, Ms. Deplorable. Let us mull over and count the ways you lost the election. Well, isn't this the representative of our world, a number one problem? If your attention is over here on something not real, like climate change, you miss the real threat, the spread of ISIS terrorism. In our Western communities, what if nations of the world, instead of a Kyoto Accord, had a Raqqa Accord? How about that for a myopic focus? And these scientists aren't stupid. They are simply going along with global plan in order to keep the gravy train. All right. So now, man, I had so many stories today, but as always, the time kind of sops up. Sleeping pills are as bad as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. If a friend is mean to you and criticizes you, they've studied it, and they say that the reason for that is to make you a better person. Have a tropical development down in Mexico. We'll see if it heads up this way. Philippines president was joking about his soldiers raping women, and Chelsea Clinton Twittered how terrible that was, and so he jumped on her about her dad sleeping with interns. Now, let's see if anything else here. I've actually got a little clip on how supercell thunderstorms happen because of the supercell that we just went through. I thought you might find interesting.
Damage from the tornadoes, and tornadoes in January, that just seems so odd.
Strange, but oftentimes coming from supercell thunderstorms. This guy has more on that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because typically the questions I've been getting from the school kids have been all about winter and snow. And then this question came in, and sure enough, today we had that occur. And I'll talk about why. I talked about cold and warm. But here is the question from Horizon Elementary.
Hello, my name is George. I go to Horizon, and this is my question. How did a supercell thunderstorm happen?
Thank you, George. Great question there. How does a supercell thunderstorm happen? And here's George's picture that he was holding up here. And he's got a lot going on here. Look at all the lightning that's occurring. And I think there's a lot of damage here along the ground here. Look at this tree tipping on over. And we saw a lot of damage today from the supercell thunderstorm. And what makes a supercell thunderstorm different from a typical thunderstorm is that you have rotation involved. And here's the key. And this is why. To get a thunderstorm to form, you have to have air to rise and cool. It's hot air. Warm, moist air rises. It cools, condenses, and makes clouds and then rain. Well, then the rain falls, it brings cool air down. Okay, the water cools the air. So that updraft that's coming in, that's warm and moist, when it gets hit with the down draft of cool air, which you can sometimes get damaging surface winds, it tends to kill the updraft. If you get a thunderstorm to rotate, what happens is the wind will come on in a circular pattern. It'll rotate in, and the downdraft will be separate from the updraft. That's when a thunderstorm will continue to live, because now you're feeding it all the moisture it needs, and the damaging winds and the tornado that can then ensue will be separate from what is going on with the updraft. So that's why you'll keep these things going. Of course, you get the hail up there as well, and you get that with rotation. You need to have.
I don't even know if that. I think that addresses storms that come in that are part of these tornado events. All right, here's a little bit from Tony Deo. Hotels.
And it's lifting it.
I'm going to get rid of this other clip here. Tony Deo, hotels.
I'm not a teacher anymore. I'm a comedian. I get to travel a little bit, which I love. But it's not always great. A couple weeks ago, I had to stay at the Super 8 Motel. Yeah. I don't know what the 8 stands for. But I do know it is not the number of things at the motel that are super. Otherwise, they would call it the Super Zero. Check into your room, you're like, hey, look at that. Weird stains on the carpet. Super. And thermostat is for decoration only. Fantastic. I think they should rename that place the Crappy 37. I counted. That's the number. At the motel, they had one of those little signs you hang on the door. It said, do not disturb. Right below that, it said, no moleste. Yeah. I didn't realize that second part was in Spanish. I just thought they were my two choices. You know, on the one hand, I don't want to be disturbed. But on the other hand, I really don't want to be molested.
All right, folks, thanks for tuning in. Enjoyed spending some time with you today on this first day of June. And I'll take you out with a little of our lost hero, guitar hero, Greg Allman. Have a wonderful day. See you back in 22 hours. Ciao. Kelly O'Connell, AM Los Cruces, AM 1450.